So I'm going to like to introduce first Catherine Marshall. She's a senior scholar with the Center of Excellence in Women's Health at the University of Arizona and a research associate with the UA Department of Disability and Psychoeducational Studies. In April 2007, she received an NIH Research Service Award for Individual Senior Fellowship, which supported her research in cancer control and the influence of family. She's the editor of the book, Surviving Cancer as a Family and Helping Co-Survivors Thrive, and she's here with her colleague from Scotland, who she will introduce, and we're so happy to have you both here.
I'm not still inebriated from the party last, with the mental health party. I'm frozen, though, I must say.
We had a great reception last night. It was a pleasure. You should come to New Orleans next year and join us.
Yes, I'll give the pitch for the mental health division. If you're not a member, you really do need to join, especially for these parties. They're quite excellent. So I'm really, really honored to be a part of this panel, and I want to just mention that my past has been in community mental health. I actually was in Boston in the mid-70s and had an internship at the Boston State Psychiatric Hospital and was a part of the deinstitutionalization movement where we actually moved patients to the Solomon Carter Fuller Mental Health Center. And I remember Senator Kennedy was here at the time to actually open the Solomon Carter Fuller Mental Health Center. So I feel like I'm coming home in a lot of ways, and I hang my hat on the future with the ACA. So I hope as we go through this presentation that you'll be thinking about notions of positive health in the community and how mental health can truly be for all and the prevention possibilities here. So in terms of the thinking globally, acting locally, again, we think we have a perfect presentation for you today. I'm in Tucson, Arizona, and I went to Finland and to Scotland trying to recruit help for this work, and my colleague, Dr. Tilo Kroll, is here, so I'll press on because he's going to be joining me. I would mention that our group has a number of wonderful folks who've been a part of the paper and the presentation. Jean Diemler is here. Hopefully, if you have questions, you can ask her as well. I would mention Dr. Francisco Garcia, who has been sponsoring my work for the past decade and who in the past year became the director of the Pima County Health Department in Tucson. And again, as I mentioned, Dr. Kroll is here and will be joining me mid-presentation. He's here with us from the Social Dimensions of Health Institute in Scotland. And in case you don't, if you don't know exactly where that is, here you see, this is actually, Tilo is here at the end of the table now, happily. He's normally in Dundee, where the big A is. And so again, I have two objectives I'd like to get through. Dr. Kroll will take over with our third objective. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the psychosocial support needs of co-survivors of cancer and how we're then trying to meet these needs and infuse our intervention through using community health workers in the community. So I will just quickly say that co-survivors of cancer are family members or friends who can be so deeply affected by a cancer experience of their loved ones that they are considered cancer survivors themselves. I have a number of references on these slides. I hope you'll consider these slides as sort of visual aids. And if you'd like copies of papers where we talk about much of the slides that I'll go through, I'm happy to give you those papers as well. In summarizing some of the stressors that families face, there is, and as you think about what we know about the impact of stress on our bodies and our well-being, and every time you hear fear, think of stress. Again, fear of recurrence, fear of complications, fear of late effects, fear of death, and financial strain. I will say from a personal note that it was financial strain that led me to this particular area of research. And that came from my own growing up in southern Appalachia in northwest Georgia, from a low-income family where we did not have health insurance. And my father had minimal interaction with the medical profession until his cancer diagnosis. This is one of my favorite quotes about cancer and poverty, and a beautiful man, Dr. Harold Freeman, who says that the thing women had in common when they walked in the door of Harlem Hospital with cancer was that they were poor, and that poverty should not be an offense that is punishable by death. This beautiful man has really led the charge in the United States, I think, of looking at the intersection of cancer and poverty. And I attempted, citing him frequently, to do a little paper with colleagues where we said, you know what, we all really believe in the importance of cultural issues. We really believe that social class, and I appreciated your presentation so much in terms of unemployment issues and suicide and poverty. But we said, can we not look at these together? Do we have to separate them? Can we not really keep paying attention to both culture and social class in terms of how families are affected by cancer? So a little study that I did early on a few years ago, we went out to look for low-income people in Tucson. And with that lens, in Tucson, Arizona, you see a lot of folks who are, in fact, Hispanic. So again, the red bars show you folks who were Hispanic. You're not going to be able to read the little bubbles over there, but again, for the purposes of this presentation, I'll tell you two things. One, there is a paper we have that looks at this particular study, 2011, called Like a Mexican Wedding, the Psychosocial Intervention Needs of Predominantly Hispanic Low-Income Female Co-Survivors of Cancer. But the main thing that we wanted to get at that we found there was, again, that families were feeling very stressed by this cancer diagnosis. For example, you have a sister who said, I felt powerless, like being very mad or feeling very helpless. How could I help her? She's feeling stressed all the time. And my favorite public health quote from this study, she says, this is a sister, in my case, I have noticed that I'm driving very bad. I was at a red light waiting the green light, and I ran the red light, just like that. It's been two times now this has happened, so it came to a point, last time this happened, that I realized my head was not reacting normally. It's like a deep depression, a lot of pressure. A bit more on family stress, I tell you. A lot of these families are dealing with immigration status or lack thereof. They are living in Arizona, where we did this work, sin papeles. They don't have papers. They might have a Social Security number, but then if you say, is that Social Security number a good Social Security number? The answer is no. So we don't have time in this presentation to go on about what it means to be poor, what it means to have cancer, which if you don't know is a very expensive disease to be treated, what it means if you're a family member trying to help a poor family member who has cancer but who does not have legal status in the United States. And so I have to just throw in here, this is a 2005 quote from a local paper in Tucson, just to remind you, that it is not against the law to assist a person in distress, no matter who that person might be. You can offer water, food, or a wet bandana to anyone you want. As a citizen of the United States, you're free to behave like a human being. And as an aside, after we get the ACA sorted out, if you'd like to support meaningful immigration reform so that we're not killing people in the desert here, that would be terrific. Because keep in mind, if people get through 50 miles of desert as a sort of a job test, then they actually can get a job. And then things are actually okay until they get cancer. And then it's a bad time for everybody. So this was a little intervention that we developed with colleagues in Tucson. 3 hours, three sessions. We ran this intervention for 2 years in a row. Again, this is a visual aid just to show you that, for the most part, we worked with folks who had low socioeconomic status. And here's the happy slide. I'm more of a qualitative researcher, so I'll just tell you that pink means that after you leave our three-hour intervention, which is sort of like, what is cancer, what support's available to you as a family member, et cetera, that you go out with increased cancer knowledge. Note that's year one, year two as well, and combined. And then you also leave with increased self-efficacy. So we asked the one question item that says, do you believe that, are you confident that you have the knowledge you need to do what you need to do to help your loved one with cancer? So in, not so much, out, yes, and that was statistically significant. Now what's exciting about that in terms of the second year matching the first year means that, which was the second objective for my part of the presentation, was that you don't have to use the trained professional such as myself to deliver this intervention. The second year, we actually trained community health workers. So folks from the community who may not have any professional training whatsoever, but who speak the language, who know the people, and can go out into their homes, into the schools, into public libraries, and deliver this little intervention as well. And just as good as I did. So, again, I would like to acknowledge Dr. Garcia for this piece. That under the Affordable Care Act, we're thrilled that community health workers are included in the definition of healthcare providers. We believe that chronic diseases related services will certainly increase, including cancer. We believe little simple, relatively inexpensive interventions, such as our Un Abrazo intervention, can better position family members as healthcare service consumers with the information to help as families to make rational healthcare decisions. And we do believe that a holistic, integrated approach to the delivery of cancer related services would have the benefit of impacting not just the individual with cancer, but the family and social network as well. And we would hope that that kind of embracing the family approach would really benefit everyone in the family as well as the community in terms of mental health outcomes. With that, I have time to introduce again my colleague, Dr. Kilo Kroll, who I went to in Scotland and begged him to come to Arizona, where I promised it would be warm last January, but it was freezing. But here he is in your own city of Boston, those of you from Boston, and would you take over for me?
Thank you, Catherine. Thanks for the nice introductions. A delight to be here and to share the panel with these great speakers, you know, that came before. And I'm quite excited to talk about FRED, and I think FRED is quite a memorable acronym for something that we talked about in January when we were in Arizona and gave birth really to FRED. And so it's still a toddler, I think, well, maybe less than a toddler, and probably, well, mostly I am a little bit guilty of child neglect there, because we're developing FRED slowly, and it gets not bottle fed, but anyway, carrying on, I tell you a little bit of what FRED stands about. It's a new interdisciplinary platform. It's really a platform for dialogue, for developing research ideas, but also for sharing knowledge and information about family-focused research. And as Catherine said, so the unit of analysis often for us is the individual, but obviously the individual is connected to other people and context and systems and layers of system. And we pretty much understand our family-focused research platform, the FRED platform, as an opportunity to develop an ecological thinking around mental health, but also physical healthcare issues and well-being issues. So, like I said, founded in 2013 in January, it's a network that really has the goal to look at research with a focus on socially disadvantaged families, and often families who face compound marginalization and disadvantage. And we also understand that it's really important to look at families within their respective sociocultural settings. And we can create many educational developmental opportunities, interventions, but we need to look really at the context first and the networks first that exists. And the word resilience was mentioned a while ago, and I think that's equally important as looking at the problems, looking at community resources and resilience that exists or that could be harnessed. We use a variety of methodological approaches, qualitative, quantitative methodologies, and also I think what I quite find exciting is to bring a range of practitioners together. So I think often we think in our silos, and I'm from the Social Dimension of Health Institute, which is an equally interdisciplinary platform as FRED, but we're just operating between two universities in Scotland, but bringing together people like architecture, from the arts, from psychology, from psychiatry, from the health and medical disciplines in the wider sense. And it's a vibrant environment. You ask questions in new and different unprecedented ways, which is quite exciting. The other thing is FRED is an international platform. And over the years, I think also in SDHI, in the Social Dimension of Health Institute, we've learned to benefit really from the knowledge and expertise and experience from people in many different settings. Currently, we're working with colleagues in India, in South America, in the United States, and across Europe. And I think that is really helpful for us to really understand people in context, in settings. FRED has three pillars. One, obviously, is the interdisciplinary research that we want to conduct. The second thing is mobilizing knowledge, getting information across boundaries, across settings, applying. We're talking a lot about cancer today, but equally other conditions such as depression that were mentioned, such as other mental health issues, but also in Dundee, for instance, we're working very much with people after stroke and understanding the implications for stroke recovery. So mobilizing knowledge across disciplines, populations, settings, and international boundaries is really important. We're doing that with in the form of webinars. We haven't done that yet under the FRED banner, but we will do so probably in 2014 to publicize the work of FRED. And thirdly, I think we're very keen on developing capacity and capability, working really locally with community members, as was mentioned, in really understanding community context and the people operating in the community, and being open. I mean, FRED is an open door platform, you know, so if you have any ideas, thoughts, please send them to us, and we are happy to develop them further. So, going into, in the interest of time, already talked about the international border crossing, and like I said, it's open for anyone with an interest, whether it's an academic or non-academic interest, to bring to us anything that needs to be researched with a family focus on and a family-focused approach. And just give you a little flavor of some studies that have been conducted. And it's a bit difficult for me not having been involved in these two particular studies, but they have come under the FRED platform. And one, what they share in common with the initial example that Catherine gave is that they're all related to cancer initially. And the next two ones are examples of how young people really respond to a cancer diagnosis of their parents. This one by Susan Silverberg-Kerner, who is now at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, has looked at the adolescents' distress reactions to parental cancers. And she it is clear that elevated anxiety, depression, worry, anger, uncertainty, and a variety of psychosomatic symptoms such as headaches have been described in the literature. And so there's an elevated clinical stress response that many of these young people face. Often in the context of the cancer diagnosis and treatment, these young people often feel overlooked, unappreciated, because of so many things are going on related to the management of the illness that actually this affects their developmental trajectories. I'm not talking much more about that particular study. It's just to give you a flavor, you know, of what's in the context of FRED at the moment. This is by our colleague Mika Niemele, who is in Helsinki at the National Institute for Health and Welfare. And his work has very much focused on child-centered interventions to support families with a parent suffering from cancer. Again, so the diagnosis of cancer is with the parent, but often the children in the family are not at the forefront of concern. And what we see here is a variety of bar charts. And it's just to illustrate, this is derived from an age cohort from 1987 through 2008, around 60,000 Finnish children, and around 6-7% of them have been diagnosed with a psychiatric diagnosis. So these are all children around 3,000 are affected by parental cancer. And you can see on the right-hand side, if there's a compound situation that the father, for instance, has a cancer diagnosis and the mother is in a psychiatric, receives psychiatric or psychological care and support, then children are equally more likely to, or proportionally more likely to also in being in need of psychiatric or psychological care. So what they do in Finland is really to raise the attention, to raise awareness for the issue of children in the family. And first of all, there's a need to talk about whether families have children that need to be considered in the family. So if someone gets diagnosed with cancer, the question is, you know, do you have children? That's the first step. And we need to talk about these children in the families. So there's a pyramid that was developed in the context of this study, saying all professionals are encouraged, really, in the Finnish healthcare context, to ask possible parents or potential parents whether they had children and what they want the children to know about their cancer diagnosis. So it's a universal intervention. It's really saying, well, let's talk about children. And it is covering, and it's currently being rolled out across Finland, and it's called the Let's Talk intervention. So getting this into routine care and not making it optional. And then along this pyramid, there is a number of services that can be tailored to the specific needs, with a clear emphasis to really preempt or prevent really the onset of psychiatric or mental health issues from developing. So really preventing that early on, discovering, identifying early on, and before it gets too compounded or too late. So some acknowledgements before I close. There are a number of grants that have so far supported these various research activities, and we hope that the list will grow much, much longer, and that there's also an opportunity to tap into many research grant resources, both in Europe as well as elsewhere in the U.S. in the future to develop new interesting research projects. So we'll invite you to join us, to join Fred to help see him through puberty and hopefully into adulthood, and or her. Fred might be Frederike, we don't know. Anyway, so thank you very much.